All right, back on the Young Turks, second hour. Hannah Cranston from the Think Tank, Francis Maxwell from TYT Sports. Now, it's always a shame when Anna's away, of course, but on the upside, I love doing the show with more of you guys. And it's great to have the whole network represented. So God bless, welcome.
Nice. Thank you.
Excited to be here, yeah.
We seem to always do a panel together. I know. It usually gets a little fiery. I like it.
Okay. You think it's going to get fiery today?
Well, I don't know. We'll I don't know if it'll clash on it, Hannah. We'll see.
Okay, looking forward to it already. All right, let me tell you who contributed to the Journalism Drive in the last hour. $27 from Rena in Florida. $100 from Joanne in Delaware and $127 from Marsha in New Hampshire. Did we get to 1.670? Let me see it. Here it comes. No. Okay. No. But we're almost. Okay. Well, it says it right there. TYTnetwork.com/go. Okay. Mandy writes in: Trump is Joffrey, Ivanka is Cersei. She's pulling a lot more strings than we think. Yeah, perhaps. Interesting. And Kicking It says, all this happening, I tend to wonder, where are the Democrats? We need to move aside and let the unsilent minority take over. So justicedemocrats.com, those are Democrats who are actually fighting back. There's going to be a lot of fun, exciting announcements coming from Justice Democrats soon. Ooh, drums. And I am going to be making a speech slash rally in Washington, D.C.
Nice.
That's on April 30th, that's right after the White House Correspondents' Dinner. We're doing a Watchdog Correspondents' Dinner right across the street from that dinner. But if you want to get information on where the rally slash speech is and when it is, you could do one of two things. One is text TYT, obviously the letters TYT, to 228466. Or you can go to tytnetwork.com/get updates. Either way, we'll let you know exactly where and when that is going to be in Washington, and we'd love to see you there. All right, rock and roll. Hannah, what do you got next for us?
All right. So a new report out of Harvard University reveals a pretty troubling fate for a lot of the unaccompanied child refugees from Syria, Afghanistan, and Pakistan. Now, for these child migrants who end up in Greece, it appears as though they are being forced to sell their bodies in order to afford the journey to the UK and other European countries. Now, the report found that the average price of a sexual transaction with a child is about 15 euros or about 1,250 pounds, okay? Oof. So it costs to go from Greece to the UK thousands and thousands of euros. So most of the time, this isn't even enough to get them where they need to go to pay the smugglers to make the journey, all right? Now, the largest group of children selling sex are Afghani boys, along with Syrians, Iraqis, and Iranians. The majority of customers are older men aged 35 and over. Now, the report also found that some of the children selling sex become addicted to drugs, making it even less likely that they will be able to afford to pay smugglers and leave Greece to continue with their journeys. Further, it also identifies that rape and other forms of sexual assault of young children in the camps, an increase in child marriage and blackmail of some children who have been abused and had humiliating photos taken of them by mafia gangs who blackmail them by threatening to send the photos to unaccompanied children's families back home. So obviously, this is a really sad situation. It's sad, I mean, with the refugee crisis and these kids. A lot of the times they're coming over sent by their parents from these war-torn countries to find a better life. And they're here, they're hoping to get to European countries. And as we know, a lot of the European countries sort of closed their borders last year. And so they got stuck in Greece after coming over through Turkey. And they estimate that there's about 2,300 unaccompanied minors in Greece at the moment right now who are, you know, don't really have a place to go when they don't have translators and they don't have a lot of other sort of easier ways that could help them sort of make the transition, hopefully, to other countries. And so, unfortunately, they have been put in this position where they are selling sex to make money. And it's really sad.
Yeah.
So, this is one of the most tragic stories there is about the refugee crisis. And as we have people fear-mongering around Syria, and especially as we have someone saying that he cares so much about the beautiful babies that he's willing to bomb Assad's government, we still have that same person here in the US not willing to take in any Syrian refugees. So whether they're beautiful babies or not, as Trump calls them, he's like, if they're gassed, then we'll bomb people. Will we take them in? No, don't care. You hear this story, I mean, what kind of a person doesn't think this is heartbreaking?
Yeah.
Right.
And it's not just Syrians, it is Afghans, Iraqis, Iranians, and Syrians overall. But very few have been placed into Europe, 191 last year. Mm-hmm. And that's it, 191. I mean, some numbers have it at over 5,000 unaccompanied kids. And it takes thousands of dollars to get to the countries if they want to go in through the ways that Hannah described. At, I mean, $12 and, you know, or 12 pounds, I should say, 12 and a half pounds. I mean, that's a disaster. They're not, it's not going to work. They're not even going to get there. And now some of them are getting hooked on drugs. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is what they came to the West for. We got to find a way to help.
And there is a solution. Real quick, I just want to give you guys a little bit of background. So for the Home Office, which is the immigration office in the UK, they actually have this Dubs Amendment, which would allow the UK to bring in a bunch of unaccompanied minors and help them rehabilitate within the region. And unfortunately, they actually ended the Dubs scheme. It was supposed to take in about 3,000, which would essentially take all these kids. They estimate there's about 2,300, which would allow all these children to come in. And they stopped it after taking only 350 children,
which is really
sad.
The UK definitely does a problem right there. And guys, you need to understand, in looking at some of the research, like European countries, there was an article that I'm citing here from The Guardian last year, have carried out 8% of the promised refugee relocations that they were going to say. And listen here, these are the two countries that basically took in the most refugees coming in after this agreement was Malta and Finland. If you're not from Europe, let me just describe. Both of those countries are tiny. Tiny in comparison to some of the biggest. They actually met their resettling obligations in comparison to all the bigger countries that actually agreed upon this previously, where European countries accepted less than 10% of the 160,000 refugees they promised to move to safety from unsanitary and cramped camps in Italy and Greece, as we're talking about here. And as you mentioned, this is the unfortunate repercussions of not following through on those obligations, is that these desperate, desperate people are going to try and find ways to find some sort of sanctuary to move to. And it's such a horrendous story, and it goes hand in hand with the hypocrisy that we see on this side of the pond. Now, again, I'm not going to turn around and say that the United States is at fault for what's going on here. There's plenty of other countries that have to be opening their borders as well and allowing people who are closer by to come in and try and find some safety. But at the same time, when Donald Trump is going in and bombing these areas, the first thing I tweeted out after is, if you're going to bomb them based on the reasoning that these beautiful babies were facing an assault, that's so hypocritical if you're literally not going to open up your borders and you have stated that you're not willing to let any of them in. None of them. That is the epitome of hypocrisy. So the United States has such a powerful way of potentially leading charge and opening up their borders and stating that we will accept more Syrian refugees. And in the UK, Theresa May, who's following hand in hand behind Donald Trump, she might follow suit as well and be more welcoming to open up their borders. But it is a result of these European countries not staying true to what they said they were going to do when it came to these relocations.
Now, I'm generally an optimist, but man, this story challenges your optimism about the world. Because not only are we not allowing these poor people, and we never learn from history. Same thing, you know, the St. Louis came to the shores of America during the Holocaust, and we wouldn't take them in. At least 25% of the people on that ship were then sent to concentration camps and murdered. And here we are again, and we've got, you know, mass killings in Syria, and we're not taking people in, just like in the past. And we say that ISIS is like the Nazis. We say that ISIS is the worst of the worst, let alone what Assad has done with chemical weapons. And we still won't take the victims in. And then the second part that's super depressing is most of the customers are men over the age of 35. So they're buying generally young boys, and knowing the horrible situation they're in, they look at them and think, not how can I help, but how can I take advantage for my Purian interests? It is beyond gross.
Yeah. And the unfortunate thing is to try and bring these stories to light and show some more information as to ways that other people can help and other countries can help, is it takes drastic stories like this, or people dying trying to get across the seas. Like we mentioned last year, like it's stated here in The Guardian as well, that the number of lives lost in the Aegean Sea since the agreement, this agreement I'm mentioning, took effect, is that it fell substantially from 1,125 2015-2016 to 70 the following year. But then they're going to try and find other methods to try and get out of this darkness, to try and get out of this horrendous situation. So it's on those countries that are, who have agreed to this system, agreed to this plan, to stay true to it. You can't be relying on small countries like Malta and Finland, who are only the countries that are hitting their obligations.
Yeah.
It's absurd.
Yeah, but I think you make a good point in that, like, I think it sometimes, unfortunately, there's stories like this when you hear about the atrocities that are happening and you see the picture of the little boy on the sand and things like that, that gets people to move. So far, just The Guardian has reported this story. Hopefully more outlets will report this story as well. And as horrific as it is, hopefully it will get people to move. It will get people activated. Yeah.
All right,
moving on. A white nationalist and Trump supporter that was accused of assaulting a young African American protester at a Trump rally in Kentucky back during his campaign is now flipping the script, okay? He is actually trying to sue Trump, saying that Trump incited violence, okay? He incited the violence that this man committed. All right, so I know that sounds very confusing, but I'm gonna get into it. So Matthew Hembach is a leader of the White Supremacist Traditionalist Youth Network and a vocal Trump supporter. He was a vocal Trump supporter during the campaign. So there's actually video of him assaulting this young African American woman. So let's take a look at that.
Get out. You know, in the old days, which isn't so long ago.
So as you can see in the video, Matthew is the one with the red MAGA hat, all right? And he's pushing this woman out. And he's saying that the fact that Trump said, get out of here, multiple times was the reason that he assaulted this woman. And so Trump should be to blame because now he is facing some legal ramifications for doing this. Now, these protesters who were kicked out filed civil assault and battery claims against Hembach and two other Trump supporters and accused Trump of inciting his supporters. Now, Matthew Hembach, who's actually serving as his own representation for this lawsuit, claims in his federal court filing that he acted pursuant to the directives and requests of Donald J. Trump and Donald J. Trump for president, and that if he's found liable for damages, any liability must be shifted to one or both of them. Now, I want to read a few other things from his claims because it's quite humorous, actually. So he denies physically assaulting any of these protesters, but he also levies blame at the protesters, writing that they provoked a response. Okay, by trying to disrupt a free assembly and campaign event to infringe rights of the defendants and other attendees to freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, freedom to vote, and other constitutional rights. Presumably, they also have freedom of speech, but apparently he forgot to mention that here. Now, he writes that he acted, if at all, in self-defense. Okay.
You just saw the video.
As well as in reasonable defense of others, while also contending that he was acting under Trump's instruction. Now, my favorite piece of this, and I'm going to read this out to you guys, is that he talks about how Trump is a world-famous businessman, okay, who relies on various professionals, including attorneys. So the fact that he said anything to get them out of here, whatever, he was acting under that information. And so he had to accept the knowledge of such a world famous businessman.
Yep.
Well, of course.
Yes.
So many things that I love about this story. So first of all, it doesn't matter if you're right wing or left wing. You don't have the right to push people around at rallies, even if they're disrupting the rallies. You wait for the authorities, and the authorities can remove the person if they're trespassing, okay? So it's no defense to say, oh, I don't know, she was also saying things. She's the worst defense in the world. So I love that this white nationalist is defending himself because he's an idiot and he's gonna get himself in further trouble. So second of all, you saw the assault right there in the video. To say that, I don't know, she was bothering me is not a legal defense. Or that she was speaking next to me is not a legal defense for assault.
Right.
And then he goes on to basically explain that she had it coming and he kind of liked that he did it and that Trump made him do it.
Yeah.
Okay. But he's saying, in case I owe money though, world-class businessman Donald Trump should pay for it. He to me, and it's absurd, it's preposterous, he's an idiot. But there is a tiny bit of validity to the claim. As you watch that video, he's certainly liable as well. It's not like, and it's so funny. They always say, oh, liberals like to be victims and stuff. But I thought personal responsibility and all that. Did you or didn't you do it? You did do it, right? So why don't you take personal responsibility for what you did?
Right.
We can see you doing it right there, right? Now you can see him mouthing "get out," but as we ran the video with audio the first time around, didn't you heard a giant "get out"? That wasn't Heimbach. No. That was Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. So he was instructing people to get him out. And then we cut it, but he went on to say, and they made a famous clip about this, in the old days they used to take him out in stretchers, he said. Now when you tell the crowd that, and they want to go back to the old days, and you have on the hat "Make America Great Again," right?
Yeah.
What are you telling them to do?
I'm split on this. I hear what you're saying. The only reason that I have my reservations as to say that Donald Trump has influence on this. Of course, like Donald Trump's, the America that he is pushing forward today is going to encourage people to act in a certain way more so than anything else. But particularly when I do videos talking about Black Lives Matter and the message that it's been put across and what I feel is such a positive message to put across in America today, many people will see an act of atrocity and they'll often place that with Black Lives Matter, and they'll say that they caused that. That was their result. Like, what they are standing for meant that the person who was going to come out and commit such an atrocity, this is their, they need to take blame for that because that's something they've infused. When, no, it's not. Like, I just feel like you can commit an atrocity and you can put it towards anything. You could go out in the middle of the street and commit something completely awful and say, "I'm an ISIS member," and people would say, "You're part of ISIS." So I don't like to say that people who are out there committing these acts of evil and proclaiming that Donald Trump is responsible for it is because of Donald Trump. Like, this guy, specifically in this example, was going to be an idiot regardless. He had that evil within him. He was, as we mentioned there, part of a white nationalist group and has pushed forward these prejudices. The fact that Donald Trump was being aggressive in his notion might have played a role in that, but I don't want to take any blame away from this imbecile. I want it to specifically be on him. He deserves the punishment for being a racist. That's it. He deserves the punishment. I don't want to sugarcoat it any other way. The same way that if someone goes out and kills a police officer and people try to attest it as a Black Lives Matter shooting, no, it's not. That's an evil individual committing an atrocity. Don't try and deflect it away from the individual.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I agree with you on that. I don't think that Donald Trump is directly responsible for this case, but I do think this illustrates sort of this culture of no accountability. I mean, that is being exemplified right now in the highest seat in the entire country. He doesn't, it doesn't hold himself accountable for anything. And so this guy is just sort of copying that sort of, it's not my fault, it's his fault because he told me to do it. And like, just because somebody tells you to do something doesn't mean you have to do it. You still have human agency. And so you have to be responsible for your actions.
Yeah. Well, we've all heard her mom say, just because somebody else is jumping off a bridge doesn't mean you should jump off a bridge. Yeah. All that is true. But Trump went further. In those rallies, he said, hey, if you do something and they sue you, I'll pay for it. He literally said that. So if I think it's interesting to, if I was a judge, I would hear it out. I'm not saying I know exactly how I would rule. It would depend on the facts of the case and the particular laws of that state. But it's worth considering. Now, don't get me wrong, it doesn't take any responsibility away from Heimbach, and you could find both responsible. And to Francis' point about what a racist he is, he once disturbed a conservative conference, CPAC, with his friend Scott Terry. And they got an interview with, in a fight with other conservatives. And when one of the conservatives said that, that it's okay, he forgave his slave masters, presumably an African American, this guy's friend, Heimbach's friend Terry, said, "Forgive him for what? Giving him shelter and food?" So this is the mindset. Like, they don't like black people, and there's a black person.
Yeah.
And I don't know
a
that
black
he did
woman.
It. Right.
Yeah. Double whammy.
Yeah. And it doesn't matter that she's black in terms of the law, because assault is assault.
Right.
I don't know that rises to a hate crime, but clearly you have assault there. Clearly there should be consequences for that. There should have been criminal consequences, let alone civil consequences. Mm-hmm. But in this civil case, both Trump and Heimbach could pay if they're both responsible.
So my question to you then is, do you feel that when that starts to become somewhat of the narrative in this story, do you not feel that we're moving into murky territory, a territory that I frankly despise when it comes to acts of atrocity? And it's usually the right wing that are pushing this for the left. If someone goes out and kills or commits an atrocity in the name of Black Lives Matter, then all of a sudden Black Lives Matter is responsible for that. Do you see a similarity there? And that's often what the right wing pushes forward.
Yeah, no, but it's a little different, right? So, fair point, Francis. So, if you say, hey, Sean Hannity made me do it, well, no, that's too removed. Sean Hannity wasn't at that rally, and Sean Hannity might generally encourage you to do X, Y, or Z, but he didn't make you push that woman, and I can't stand anything Sean Hannity says, etc. Mm-hmm. But Trump was at the rally directing his supporters, and he said, get out. In other rallies, and this is why it's an interesting court case, in other rallies, he said to commit acts of violence and that he would pay for it if he got sued. He literally said it, right? That's why I think it's different. If somebody who was an official leader of Black Lives Matter, which has never happened, right, said, go out and kick that guy's ass and I'll pay for it if you get sued, then I would say, yeah, that's an interesting court case. Yeah.
Well, let's look at this.
But they haven't.
Let's look at this even more broadly, right? Because this was candidate Trump who's saying this, right? And so this guy is just sort of like going with the flow, thinking that he's going to be protected by this famous businessman. Now we have President Trump. Now, if he goes out and says things like, hey, I'll protect you under the law if you do X, Y, Z, if you incite violence, if you do some sort of act of bigotry, whatever it may be. I mean, people will be, you know, moved to act on that. And that's really frightening when you see how willing people, if he really felt that Donald Trump was giving him permission to do this as just a candidate, how scary is that what Donald Trump could potentially say as a president?
Yeah, I agree completely. And that's why I was just kind of posing the question out of curiosity, because every time I will post a video on Facebook condemning police brutality, like a recent video, then most people will come back and specifically say, oh, well, Black Lives Matter is pushing forward this narrative that causes this person to do this. And I'm always coming to the defense of something like that. And I feel that if you attest every act of atrocity that's committed with a Donald Trump narrative behind it, then it starts to remove accountability away from the actual person itself.
And yeah,
the
but person we're not doing that. He's
no,
saying
I, no,
that.
I feel that he's doing that. And I feel like he becomes, you say that he becomes more motivated to commit it because Trump is saying this and these things. And I feel like more people will become more motivated if it becomes a narrative that, okay, you might actually get away with committing this bullshit and these acts of horror because Donald Trump has said things in the past that might allow you to. So they might feel more inclined to go out and do it. I just want to make sure that we're not moving into that murky territory and the individuals need to be held for their individual acts.
You know? Hope that this judge holds him accountable for this awful action.
All right, we're going to take a quick break here, guys. When we come back, you know, you see Ivanka in the news a lot, and there's this like theme that you hear from the mainstream media that she's actually popular with young people or with women. Is she? Well, we're going to find out when
we
return.
What a tease.
All right, back on the Young Turks. A couple of quick tweets for you guys. Left Librarian says, Trump supporters in a nutshell, quote, I'm not responsible for anything ever, which is what they'll be soon saying about their vote for Trump. Ray for Madness says, America never takes responsibility for its actions. Why would we expect individual Americans to do so? It's learned behavior, which is exactly what you guys were worried about. All right, let's go to our people that have donated to the journalism campaign here. Shreyans from New York at $50. Theodore from Florida for $127, and $127 from Jacqueline in California. You guys remember, you can get the House TYT t-shirts now with our sigil on them. Hey, look at that. 1.671.
Wow.
We were trying to get to 1.67 by then in the last hour, and we kind of did. In fact, we went a little over. So stop now. No, I'm kidding. Keep going. We have less than 2 weeks left now, and then this campaign will be over forever. So let's try to hire as many people as we can before it's over. That's tytnetwork.com/go. You're gonna miss me saying that. Okay. And now one more thing for you guys. Today in the post game, we talked about the Korean War in the first hour. I will tell you an awesome story of my physics teacher in high school who served in the Korean War.
Oh.
Okay. And old war stories, also from World War II a little bit too. And then I had a conversation with my son about if he wanted to do what I do and what his answer was.
Oh, I'm so excited.
He's 6 years old.
Little pro. Okay.
Yeah.
Love it.
So that's for the members. Become a member at tytnetwork.com/join. All right, what's next, Hannah?
It turns out that young women in America aren't sipping the complicit Kool-Aid and actually have a pretty unfavorable view of the first daughter Ivanka Trump. Now, in a recent SurveyMonkey poll, they found that only 21% of young women, 18 to 24, have a favorable view of Ivanka. So let's look at this age breakdown. So as you can see on the far left, that's favorable. Then 52% have an unfavorable view of her. 26% don't know enough to say, and 2% no response. And then her favorability actually increases as women get older, which is really interesting. And I want to come back to this in a second. But first, I want to look at the male breakdown, because men actually have a much more favorable view of Ivanka. As you can see, it sort of increases there. And then going back to young women, 18 to 24, there's a partisan breakdown here. Republican women, 67% favorable, 17% unfavorable, and then 9% favorable for Democrats, and 73% unfavorable there as well. And this is actually really important, right? Because I think Ivanka is sort of held accountable for a lot of being like the woman, right? I think she's like the token woman in the White House, essentially, and besides Kellyanne Conway to some extent. But Ivanka's really held accountable for a lot of any sort of policy, anti-woman policy or anti-woman rhetoric and things like that. And so it makes sense that I think that she would be unfavorable amongst young women who are predominantly more liberal, right?
Yeah. Well, so there's a couple of things here. As you point out, progressives are so much more liberal. Young people are so much more liberal or progressive than previous generations, that older generations have a hard time comprehending it. They still want to talk about left, right, and all that stuff. There's very little right to speak of in 18 to 34 year olds.
Right.
So, and for the mainstream media, it's hard for them to get it through their head. They're like, what do you mean? Trump's president. So Breitbart must be doing great among the kids. Which 18 to 34 year olds are looking at Breitbart, right? Yeah. So there's some teenage boys who are trolls online and enjoy being trolls. But that's a really
I'm familiar with them.
Yes, we're all familiar with them. So yes, you have some 15 to 17 year olds who are knuckleheads and enjoy that stuff. But it's a tiny minority. So of course, among young women, she's not going to be liked, because they're very progressive and she's not. The second part of this is that she's a fraud, and it's harder to trick millennials because they actually get their information online. So they can actually look up what her policy positions are, and they can see with their own eyes that she's supporting Donald Trump, who doesn't do any of the things that she claims she's in favor of. Whereas in the mainstream media, they do these narratives, they call them narratives, right? And the narrative for Ivanka Trump is she's a moderating influence on Donald Trump, and she is helping him with women and with young people. Why? Because she's a woman and young, relatively young. Yeah. But you have no evidence of that. We have polling now that indicates the complete opposite. Right. But TV guys will say it anyway, because they do their narrative whether it's true or not true.
Yeah, no, I think it's interesting, because a lot of the times when I hear people speak favorably about Ivanka, it's older women, which, you know, I understand, and they're coming from a different sort of, let's be real, like feminist background, where they're thinking like, oh, we need to support other women, and she is this young woman who's having a say on, you know, him taking care of the people who were chemically attacked in Syria and things like that, and she's a businesswoman and all these other things. But for a lot of younger women, we don't just necessarily like look at a woman and blindly and say we have to support them, because there's a lot of women out there who spew a lot of hatred and bigotry, and this is a particular woman who is, if she is supposedly moderating the president, she's not doing a very good job at it.
Yeah, I think that it's important to highlight the notion that many people will often excuse these ratings by simply stating that, oh, it's because she's Donald Trump's daughter and people just don't like Donald Trump, so they're necessarily not going to like his daughter. And that may well be the case in some instances, but as you mentioned, Jake, it's important that she's actually held accountable, because she does have a role specifically, and as she's pushing forward this narrative that she's there to push forward women's rights, and that she's actually for a lot of things that are going forward to try and, I would say, improve Donald Trump's previous policies, that we know he's not been in favor of women, and he hasn't pushed forward policies to help women as he's looking to roll back Planned Parenthood. If she is responsible for that, she's not doing a good job at that. So rather than scrutinize her because simply put, oh, she's Donald Trump's daughter. No, no, no. She's got a role. If she's specifically with, when it comes to women involved in politics, we're not going to sugarcoat around the idea that just because she's Donald Trump's daughter, she gets an excuse and the people just don't like her because they don't like Donald Trump. She has a role that has to be held accountable for, specifically with young women looking for aspiring role models. At the moment, she's not one. And that's because her duties, she's not fulfilling those duties that she said she was going to do.
I mean, to back up what both of you are saying, proof's in the pudding. So I don't know if she's a moderating influence. I hope she is. I see articles written about how she's fighting against Steve Bannon behind the scenes. And if she winds up getting helping to get Steve Bannon out of the White House, then I'll give her credit for that. Okay, so credit where credit is due. But in terms of women's issues, she hasn't helped at all. Right. So even if she intends to do well, she hasn't.
Yeah.
She helped Donald Trump get elected, and he's been disastrous for women's rights.
I mean,
look, I can give you 1,000 examples. Let me just give one here. Look, you know that he cut funding for programs on reproductive rights, or and even ones that barely had anything to do with abortion, as Republican presidents do, etc. But one program he cut had nothing to do with abortion at all. It was a program aimed to help women internationally. It was a United Nations program, and one of the things that it does is it helps the fight against genital mutilation. And he cut the funding for that anyway. So if Ivanka Trump says she's helping women behind the scenes, well, we haven't seen it in front of the scenes at all yet.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good point. All right.
A Muslim teen in Pennsylvania dismantled a popularly held stereotype about women who used the hijab. And she did so with a text to her dad in Saudi Arabia. Now, this is a picture of Lamia, who is 17 years old. And so she was in this group chat, okay, and they were talking about politics and Trump came up, and she obviously, as a young Muslim woman in America, decided to kind of stand up for herself. She has some pretty strong views about Trump, so she stood up for herself, and somebody in the group chat responded something pretty harsh. She goes, "Stop defending Islam, bitch. Shut up. You couldn't take that scarf off or your dad would beat your ass." So she was very offended by this and decided to actually prove him wrong by texting her dad and not telling him any of sort of the context around this. So she texted her dad, "Baba, I want to tell you something." He says, "Talk to me." And then in Arabic, he says, "Are you okay, my love?" She goes, "Yeah, I'm okay. I was thinking I want to take my hijab off, okay?" Then he responds, "Sweetheart, that's not my decision to make. That's no man's decision to make. If it's what you feel like you want to do, go ahead. I'll support you no matter what. Is everything okay? Did something happen?" So she posted this next to the tweet from the person in her group chat to sort of prove that it's not always an act of oppression and that women are being forced to do so by fathers or husbands or whatever. And she got over 142,000 retweets for this text experiment that she did. A lot of people supporting her for showing this. A lot of people who also came out and talked about what their hijab means to them. Of course, she also faced some backlash for women that said, just because you're not oppressed doesn't mean that there are other women that aren't oppressed. And so I do think that this sort of is a nice example of two sides of the argument around the hijab and around sort some of the rules of Islam religion.
Yeah. So I don't like the hijab at all. So that's my personal opinion. And it's not necessary according to the Quran. So I've read the relevant sections of the Quran regarding that. It doesn't say you have to cover your head, especially if you're a woman, but not if you're a man. It just doesn't say that. But it is a cultural thing that has developed, and I think it is to keep women down. And so I know that some women have internalized it and think that they're doing it because of, well, religious reasons, cultural reasons, but in respect of their culture. I've said this 1,000 times. There are great parts of culture that should be revered. I'm a nostalgic guy. There's a lot of American culture that I love. Some parts of Turkish culture, where my family is originally from, but there's a lot of terrible parts of culture. And so we shouldn't be wed to it just because it exists. And so at the same time, I think making people take the hijab off is almost as bad as making them wear it, because you're still taking away their freedom and their liberty, and that's not the values of the culture that I agree with.
No.
Coming from a Western perspective, I think freedom says they should be allowed to do whatever you want. That doesn't mean that I can't try to dissuade them from it and we have a conversation around it. So I like that she broke down stereotypes by saying, hey, it's my choice. Mm-hmm. And you don't know what my family situation is. You don't know what my religion is. But I also think that it was interesting pushback when people said, well, in your case, it's a choice, but for a lot of women across the world, it isn't. So, yeah. And good points.
Yeah, the text message itself breaks down stereotypes. Many people assume that her father would have been in outrage at this and would have told her you're going to burn in hell for showing you for not standing by what is to believe in questioning what your decision is. Because you mentioned it there, whether you have your opinions towards what this culture represents and what these women should choose to do, is that you have your opinion, but you're not forcing it upon them. Like many Westerners feel that it's their right to try and liberate Muslim women by being like, okay, you're free now. You're in the United States. You can take that off. And that's like you're almost enforcing a very similar thing that conservative Muslims on their side are forcing towards them, because they're stating, no, you need to cover up. This is everything that you stand for. You don't have a choice. This is what you're doing. So yeah. It took me back to an article that was written in the Infusion not long ago, where a woman was basically stated in the headline, Westerners and conservative Muslims, stop telling me what to wear. And that's the whole message to put across, is that there's going to be 1,000 different opinions, but we are so naive when it comes to education surrounding the religion of Islam. We know that. Like, that's why it's so easy to push forward these misconceptions, and Donald Trump can gather everyone behind him and have this this mountainous attack towards a certain group of people, because we're so uneducated on it and we don't understand. So we just kind of flock to whatever one person says. So more stories like this are so important, because we need to educate ourselves further. Whether you believe something and you have your own opinion, as you said, Cenk, it's still not our place to try and like push our Western ideology onto people.
Yeah, Francis, I think you make a really good point, right? Because it is difficult to parse out, right? Because in some cultures, it is forced upon women, right? But when we look at more secular cultures, women who still choose to wear the hijab or not, you know, for a lot of women, there was a hashtag that said hashtag hijab to me. And a lot of women wrote about how it was a source of femininity for them, or it made them feel more bold and strong in their choice to do it. So it can mean different things to different people. And I think that's really the core of this, right? Is that we assume that Islam is somehow different than a lot of religions. And I think when we talk about it, it's different than a lot of religions. But just like any religion, it's not monolithic in its manifestation. And I think that's what we need to remember, is that for some women, the hijab might be a sign of or oppression, but for some women, it might be a source of liberation. And we need to accept both manifestations of women who decide or don't decide to wear it.
Yeah, you're right about a lot of different religions have different rules. So for example, a friend of mine is on the New Jersey coast. He's really early in the morning. He happened to get up early and he goes into the ocean and notice there's a conservative, I guess Orthodox, I don't know the specific strand of Jewish family that's there, right? And he noticed after a while there's a pattern. Every time he goes in the ocean, they come out of the ocean. He goes into the ocean, they come out of the ocean, right? He comes out of the ocean, they go back into the ocean. He's like, what the hell is going on, right? And it turns out that for that particular sect of Judaism, they couldn't have the women in the water at the same time as him. Okay, to me, that's super goofy. It's an ocean, right? There's probably guys in the ocean down in Miami at the same time as you're in there in New Jersey. But that's like their opinion, man. And it doesn't mean every Jew does it that way. It doesn't mean every Muslim wears a hijab or a burqa, and that there is a distinction between those two things. So there's a hijab movement, apparently, of people getting rid of their hijab. As a person, again, who's very secular, I love it. I think that the hijab is basically propaganda and an old school culture that we don't need and that I don't think helps women. But on the other hand, the people trying to take it off, can you imagine if you went up to, whether it's those conservative Jews in New Jersey or it's conservative Muslims in France where they're trying to get them to take their hijabs off on the beach or whatever,
right?
And you said, okay, not only do you have to take off one article of clothing above your head, you also have to take off your top. Let me see your, I want to see you topless. You'd be like, no, what?
Right.
Like, that's unbelievable. Of course you can't do that, right?
Yeah.
But why is it that much different? No, it's their choice what they get to wear. I mean, if you're secular, that should be the core of your beliefs.
Right. Yeah. No, I agree with you. I think if you are progressive and you want people to have freedom to choose or whatever, then they can choose to be really religious or they can choose to be really secular. The whole point is about having that choice and having the ability to make that choice.
Yeah.
So I think that's important. All right.
All right, next. Let's
do it. Moving on. Victoria's Secret has announced their yearly What is Sexy list, and no surprise to anybody who's ever seen a Victoria's Secret show or looked at their catalog. I've definitely just dated myself by saying catalog. It's a bunch of thin white women. So basically they said what is sexy for this year. It's bold, powerful, and confident. That's what sexy means to us, and that's what all the winners of our annual roundup embody, from artists to athletes. These women and men are at the top of their game and inspire us to work harder and keep it sexy every day. And all of these women, with exceptions of like two or three, are skinny white women, which is in line with a lot of the women that they feature in their show, in their on their website, and a lot of their ads. So we have Taylor Swift, of course, Mandy Moore. There's a few exceptions here. Vanessa Hudgens, who's a Filipino and Native American, Priyanka Chopra, and Alexa Chung. But Chrissy Teigen as well. And then, of course, we have one dude in the final graphic here, James Corden, who is apparently the sexiest late night host. I think that might be more of a function that there's not a lot of late night women hosts, but.
Yeah.
I'll save that conversation for a different video.
Wait, are there any? Right, I think that.
There used to be Samantha Chelsea Bee. Handler, but she doesn't really, she doesn't do that
Samantha
anymore.
Bee
Samantha Bee, sort of, yeah.
I like Corden representing the overweight men in the sexist category.
Well, also, there's no plus size women in this entire list.
Yeah.
Which is a problem as well. There's no black women, there's no plus size women. There's a huge issue here. Victoria's Secret, wake up.
Yeah, but we're not surprised by this, right? Skinny's been in for almost as long as I've been alive, and not always. I remember my grandpa thought that skinny women were ridiculous. They used to like fuller figures back in the day, and of course everybody varies. But in terms of the mainstream media and these magazines and these lingerie things, they've been pushing skinny women on us for forever.
Yeah, but also I think lately it's been, and in good faith, I think it's been a PR move, right? And a trend that we're seeing more plus size women in these ads, and we're seeing your Ashley Grahams, we're seeing these women, Aerie, doing unretouched ads. So it's actually the move now, I think, to have more plus size women, to have more variation, to have more diversity. Target just did a completely unretouched bathing suit campaign, which was amazing and beautiful and showing the diversity of women, and I think Victoria's Secret is actually lagging behind on the trend in this case.
I was surprised by it for the simple reason that we do a bunch of stories on sports about Sports Illustrated and their message that they put forward, because Sports Illustrated, let's be honest, right, it's mostly dudes that are going to go out and buy Sports Illustrated. You get the magazine in, you look at all the women in bikinis. So they pushed forward a message, I believe, the previous campaign where they were being more inclusive and they were being body positive, and we had women of all different shapes and sizes, and that was their message they put forward. And then they backtracked, I believe, last year, and they went back to their usual go-to, I guess, because they might not have seen the sales. I don't know necessarily what their reasoning was, but it was surprising for Victoria's Secret because Sports Illustrated is aimed at a male demographic. Yeah, most guys will probably tune in to watch the Victoria's Secret fashion show because we're kind of perverted and we want to go and watch that. And we can sit down with our girlfriend and pretend that we're just there to watch it with her because they watch it also.
Does any girlfriend buy that? I want to check out the latest fashion with you.
I want to check out what I'm going to buy you for Valentine's Day.
Yeah.
So, but they sell clothing to all different women shapes and sizes. So you would think that if they were to push forward a message that in the end is going to affect their bottom line, which everyone, regardless of what you make yourself think, is out there to do, is to increase their profits, that they would try to be more encouraging to not just the skinny stereotype, that they would want to push forward and promote women of all shapes and sizes, because they sell to all shapes and sizes, if I'm correct.
The range, right, yeah.
Yeah, but you know, that's the amazing thing about marketing, though. If you, the conventional wisdom, and I think there's certainly elements of it that are correct, is that if you put women that society has marketed as not as attractive into the ads, it drives people away, because people aspire to be the people that they see in those ads. So look, in terms of males and what we're attracted to, think of the power of marketing in that I'm serious. Like in my grandfather's generation, women who were plus size were much more desirable, considered much more desirable, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. My father's generation is somewhere in the middle. And for us, we have internalized it that skinny women are more attractive. And it is the power of mass marketing, and it's fascinating. And I think that it's had a different effect on women where they think, oh, if it's someone that I have been taught is attractive, well, I want to be like that, and hence I'll buy it.
But what a power to hold, right? Think about how many women watch Victoria's Secret. Think about that is like one of the probably the most known, well-known lingerie brand in the world. What a beautiful power that they have to be able to show women of different shapes and sizes and to show women the diverse range of beauty that exists. I think it's really frustrating as a woman to look through these magazines and only see one type of woman. A lot of the times that is an unrealistic ideal for so many women around the world. And so I think it's really important that these companies in 2017 step forward and start to make a real difference in showing women themselves in these magazines. And so, and it's not fair to say that like, oh, that skinny is hot, because that's not necessarily true for most people, like for your father or for whomever. Like there's a lot of people who are into all different, you know, shapes and sizes and whatever. Like let's show those women too and show them that they are also hot and sexy.
So I've just got a question out of curiosity,
yeah.
because I know you've talked about, you watch the Victoria's Secret mm-hmm. Fashion shows. When you're watching it, what is your thought process? Are you, when you see these women, are you motivated? Are you like, do you want to go out and try to aspire? Like, is, you know, you're very in shape and you go out.
Yeah, no, I'll be completely, completely honest. I am a thinner white woman myself. Mm-hmm. And I watch that show and feel really shitty about myself. And
really?
Feel that I need to eat healthier and go to the gym and all these things. And I think I'm, you know, I'm very body positive. I'm very open with that on my Instagram and like talking about that and the way that I work out and the way that I carry myself 100%. But even myself as a thin white woman who, you know, is more similar, I think, than the rest, not similar to a Victoria's Secret model, let me just be honest. But I just mean, you know, more similar than the larger demographic. I feel so shitty about myself watching that show. I enjoy, like, it's like a hate watch sort of thing. But I can't even imagine for the majority of the country what they look like. And it's just, it sickens me. And I think these women are great and a lot of them have great causes. And I don't want to, you know, fault the angels for anything or whatever like that. But I do fault Victoria's Secret for not having more diversity when it comes to who they show in both their ads, who they show in the show, because it is so, so important for young girls to see an advertisement and to see in the media girls who look like them. And so that they don't feel like they're an outcast or they have to change in some sort of way to fit these unrealistic beauty standards that the media sets out for them. I think this is crucial. I think Victoria's Secret needs to step up to the plate and, you know, catch on to the trend and then also lead the trend because this is a huge change that we need to see for young women and frankly for young men.
Well, at this point I'm impervious to marketing because as I told you in the past, like, yeah, I mean, we got marketed into our heads that this is what's attractive. But like if I see a guy who looks great on a billboard or whatever, I'm like, well, he plays his game, I play my game. Somebody pass me a cheesesteak. Okay, let's see if we can squeeze in the next story in a minute and a half. Go.
All right. So it seems as though United's PR person cannot catch a break. There was a guy who was dragged off the plane. Then there was a scorpion who fell on a United plane and stung somebody. And then there was another just married couple who was dragged off the plane. And now they're at it again because their stock markets are declined for United. And additionally, apparently most Americans would rather pay more for a flight, all right, then take United. All right, so listen to this. So according to a morning consult poll that surveyed a national sample of 1,900 American adults, 79% of respondents who had heard about United's recent news said they would choose a different airline if that airline, the poll specifically used American Airlines as a stand-in, offered an identical flight for the same price. Okay, so that's if there's the same price, right? Now, when presented with a hypothetical scenario in which the competing flight was both more expensive and longer, requiring a layover instead of a direct arrival, 44% of the respondents who had heard about United's recent news would still choose the alternative flight rather than fly United. This blows my mind. This shows you just how important PR is, and especially responding to sort of negative PR situations. I mean, the United CEO responded very negatively.
Yeah. The thing that I love about it is finally we're getting pushback from customers on planes going, I'm not going to take this behavior anymore. They pushed around us around for way too long. And this is us saying, we'll even pay more to stop this nonsense. God bless. Okay, we're out of time. We'll see you in the postgame.
Bye-bye.